Hello and welcome to the Affairs Current Podcast. My name is Coda Vance, your host, and with me today is returning champion Alex Hill. How are you doing today, Alex?
Pretty good. Good morning from Ulsan, South Korea.
It's good to hear you're still doing well over there, Alex. So today we have a bit of a focused episode than usual. We have two topics that focus a bit about East Asia, broadly speaking. But before we get to that, of course, our email, as always, is theaffairscurrent@gmail.com. Our blog, where all the show notes will be posted, theaffairscurrent.blogspot.com. Again, we encourage feedback about sound quality, about topics, about anything you'd like to talk to us about on both of those forums, as well as our Facebook and Twitter pages. I keep forgetting to talk about those as well, but that's facebook.com/theaffairscurrent and Twitter, theaffairscurrent. So today we have two topics. We're going to be talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which big, of course, big trade deal recently signed. Is it good? Is it bad? Or is that an unfair question? And then the second topic will be a sort of broad discussion about China-South Korea relations, although it could kind of take us in some different directions there. But just to start with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, so I mean, the first disclaimer we should make in this discussion is that the full text of the agreement is not yet available. There have been draft leaks of the text, of course, very famously by WikiLeaks in, I believe, 2013. So we don't know exactly what is in this agreement. So that's the first big headline. Now we can kind of talk about the level of secrecy with which these talks were conducted and sort of the stakeholders who were invited versus weren't invited to the table to be privy to that. But nevertheless, we should point out, you know, anything we say here could be contradicted by the final text of the agreement. Of course, we should be going broadly on what the people who negotiated it have touted it as and what the critics of it have been saying that it will affect as well. So I guess just to start with your thoughts, Alex, do you have a broad position on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or is it a little more complicated than that for you?
I mean, it is certainly going to go down as a landmark trade negotiation. The changes that it's going to bring about, I think, are much bigger than anything from a Canadian perspective that the NAFTA brought about. It would create the largest, or will create rather, the largest trading bloc in the world that dwarfs even the European Union in size. So
I believe it's 40% of the world economy is included in this agreement.
Yeah. As with many trade agreements that are being signed these days, I do have some questions about whether or not this is in fact a truly free trade agreement. There have certainly been instances of trade agreements entered into by, for example, Canada in the past where we have done our bit and followed the rules, and then other nations have not, and we don't really have any recourse. I also, all the numbers I've seen seem to indicate that the amount of economic growth that will result from this deal is pretty modest, and in return, we're going to be paying some pretty high costs in terms of our sovereignty, and there's lots of nasty stuff. Again, we don't know the details, but it seems related to intellectual property law and really things that shouldn't have any place in a free trade agreement. So I'm, although in general supportive of the idea of trade liberalization, I'm a bit wary about this deal.
Yeah, so I think I'm going to accord largely with what you said there. I think there's... See, I think there's a problem when discussing free trade in political circles. There's, you know, the ideal of free trade, which is discussed by people like Adam Smith, David Ricardo. You know, there is this intellectual idea of free trade. And I think, you know, from left to right, most economists who are not, you know, actual Marxian socialist types most economists who say that, yeah, you know, who have a broad acceptance of market economics, I should say, will say, yes, free trade ideally is what you want. Because it does provide for specialization. It does, over the long term, balance things out. However, the problem is when we get into discussing free trade agreements, and I'm using air quotes, listeners, that you can't see, is that the problem is that idea gets hitched into these free trade agreements. And we should be very clear that, you know, any sort of free trade agreement, any sort of trade agreement, is ultimately just a series of clauses and conditions surrounding all kinds of different issues. And normally, you know, in the past, this was specifically about tariffs, specifically about other sorts of protectionist measures that countries would engage in to protect domestic industries or to encourage growth in nascent features. And I mean, there's a school of economics, sort of more heterodox thinkers like Eric Reinhart, Hanjun Chang, who would say that that was actually necessary for the growth of certain countries to engage in those protectionist sorts of policies for a little while to get things started. Now, that's perhaps we can discuss that a little bit later. But just to say that, you know, any trade agreement is not the intellectual idea of free trade. So one could be very supportive of the intellectual idea of free trade, which I am, without necessarily supporting all these trade agreements. Now, of course, you know, the counter to that is, well, you know, anything is going to contain good and bad, particularly your smaller country like Canada. You know, can you afford not to be part of these sorts of agreements? But to me, that sort of ends up saying, well, you know, no matter how bad any agreement is, we ultimately have to sign on to it because it's going to include all these other economies, right? So I think that that kind of breaks down at a certain point. But you're very right to bring up some very trenchant issues regarding privacy law, regarding drug costs. And, you know, the people raising the concerns around this issue are not, you know, the usual suspects who are blanketly opposed to free trade. It's not, in a lot of cases, the you know, special interests who are going to be directly harmed by it. Now, those people are, of course, complaining as well, and I think we'll talk about that in a little bit. But, you know, it's people like Médecins Sans Frontières, it's people like the Sierra Club, it's people who have, you know, interests in specific areas of public policy, no doubt, but are not blanketly against free trade, saying that this is going to push up drug costs, this is going to, you know, the environmental protections don't really have teeth, and it's going to create all these sorts of harmful incentives to raise the bottom. And, you know, people like Paul Krugman, who is in favor of free trade, have said this isn't even really a trade agreement in the traditional sense. A lot of it covers things like, you know, intellectual property laws you were mentioning and, you know, internet privacy. And those costs are really kind of being baked into this. So I guess a kind of question coming out of that is, you know, is it even right to call the Trans-Pacific Partnership a trade agreement in the traditional sense of that term?
Well, as I alluded to, I don't think it is. And what's interesting when you have such a diverse range of countries coming together to try and hash out a deal, the product, not only the process, is very political. So it's pretty arbitrary in terms of what specific industries become liberalized and to what extent and which ones do not. So in spite of all of these different trade agreements, the United States agricultural industry will maintain as always protected. And in spite of some symbolic concessions, Canada's supply management system will remain largely intact. And I think the government will shell out huge sums of taxpayer dollars to compensate farmers for any perceived loss. But just to use an example of, you know, whether or not, in fact, these deals will actually bring about free trade that involves both Korea and Canada. Last fall, we finally negotiated and signed a free trade agreement with South Korea. And part of the supposed gains that we would get from trade was a new base to export our agricultural products, particularly things like beef and salmon and other raw resources. Since the winter, however, the Koreans have been barring any Canadian beef from coming into the country. Their excuse being that there are serious health and safety concerns related to mad cow. The reality is that that is one solitary case that they were pointing to. And in the past, the Koreans, who heavily protect their agricultural industry, have made those sorts of excuses. So on the other hand, you can kind of see where some people are coming from when they say, certain health and environmental and safety regulations are actually just a way to embrace protectionism without imposing an outright tariff. So I think it's really a mixed bag.
Well, I think the issue there, as far as the South Korean agreement goes, is like, yeah, you're right. I think in that sense, the Canadian trade negotiators, I mean, I wouldn't want to second guess people, but I don't think they did a particularly adequate job in ensuring that access would be given, because as you alluded to, the South Korean government has a history of doing this. They did it to the Americans in 2006, I believe. They've done it to a lot of different countries. And yeah, if the goal is to have more market access, we can't get into a situation where, based on these sort of spurious excuses, countries can just close off market access like that. But as you alluded to, I think there's a very important point to be made about sort of, at least in Canada, the way this debate has been portrayed, has been really bad, in my opinion, in the sense of, it seems like the way it's being presented in the media, and also, I will be fair, by all the political parties, has been the harms, quote-unquote, from this agreement will be to things like the Canadian dairy industry, will be to things like the egg industry, the poultry industry, I should say, and, very specific other sorts of things, without actually discussing some of these bigger issues related to internet privacy, related to drug costs, related to environmental costs in the third world and also here. And I think that kind of speaks to the fact that those lobbies, or whatever you want to call them, are not particularly well organized in the same, or given the same sort of political respect that the dairy industry is, for example. Like, it's very interesting that the Harper government likes to portray itself as this big champion of free trade. And if you actually look at the agreement as far as what it does to the dairy industry, it doesn't open it up very much at all. It's all about a 2.3% market access, plus they're going to shell out all this taxpayer money to the dairy industry to compensate it. And look, I'm not saying anything bad about dairy farmers. I have family who are dairy farmers. But, for God's sake, why are we saying that this one sector of the economy is so special and so particular that it deserves to be protected and it deserves to have a certain level of guaranteed income, when we aren't saying that for everybody in Canada, regardless of what their position is? And I think the frank fact of that is twofold. The first is that they're very well organized, they lobby very well, good for them. The second thing is, of course, that there is sort of an a general sort of social idea that farmers are somehow inherently good people and we want to help them, and we have this image of people working on a farm and that kind of thing. And look, like, I've worked on farms, like, I have family that are farmers. I'm not saying anything bad about farmers, but they are ultimately businessmen, like other businessmen. And I think people who would rightly be against subsidies for all kinds of other businesses, and we can also talk about that, what the Harper government has, and all other governments, to be fair, Industry Canada shovels corporate welfare out the door like there's no tomorrow, have been saying. But just the point being that when a subsidy goes to one particular industry, a lot of people will say, well, this is corporate welfare, etc., etc. But when it comes to the dairy industry, particularly when there's no, quote, direct subsidy involved, as with supply management, people seem to not want to go that direction. Like, if all this agreement did was dismantle supply management, I would be completely in favor of it. On the record, but it doesn't just do that. It does a lot of other harmful things. It does a lot of things related to patents. It does a lot of things related to internet privacy. And I think, again, I think it comes back to the idea of, I think the debate around this, at least in Canada, and I'm going to throw to you, how has it been playing internationally, has been very much focused on issues that are of concern only because the lobbies surrounding it are very well organized politically. But what's the Korean read on this? Is there a Korean read on this?
Well, first, I just want to touch on your point about the emphasis in the media vis-a-vis the TPP. It's very clear, as per our discussion last time I was on the program, that the issues that get play in the media and the issues to which the elected officials in our country, Canada, speak to, those are issues that have been lobbied by organizations that have lots of formal power. And if you go to the grocery store and ask the average Canadian how they feel about supply management, they probably won't even know what you're talking about. And if they do, they probably won't have a strong opinion. And if you told them as low-income Canadians they could save up to, I don't know, $1,000 a year, if we got rid of the system on their grocery bills, they would probably be in favor of abolishing it.
But the thing that the supply management advocates say, well, is if you go to Canadians, they prefer to and you ask them, do you prefer to buy Canadian cheese or whatever, they will say yes. And of course, you know, that can be phrased in all kinds of different ways, to prove whatever point you want to prove, right? So I think, just to briefly say, you know, I think that kind of speaks to the idea of, like, when you have one very well organized group that is very directly harmed by a particular policy or very directly benefits from a particular policy, they will be able to organize themselves to get the government to get the government to enforce that policy. Whereas if there's a broad swath of the population who would benefit from that policy being changed or abandoned, but they aren't well organized and they aren't politically savvy, they aren't going to be able to do it. It's the same thing with another good example of this in Ontario would be Catholic schools, right? Like, I think a lot of people would benefit if we abolished the Catholic school boards. You would have much more money for public schools. You would not be funding religiously discriminatory activities and discriminatory activities against gay people. But there's a very organized group of people that very much support that system, so the system continues.
I think the economic term for policy wonks is concentrated benefits and dispersed costs, right? And that's exactly it. But this is not an organization that in any way represents average Canadians. And I'll give two examples. One was infamously the need to conduct pilot studies in order to determine whether milk could or could not be sold in 3-liter jugs instead of in 2-liter or whatever other liter quantities. I think the National Post used the term Soviet milk czars to describe the people in charge of that decision. I think that was an apt phrase. But the other point, going back to sort of the ideal of the salt of the earth, hardworking farmer, and also the increasing connection that people, not just in Canada, but in a lot of the industrialized world, feel to their food and their farmers, the foodie movement actually has a great enemy in the supply management system. If you want to raise organic heritage breed chickens, for example, and you want a small group of animals, let's say 150, you will not be able to enter the market. And secondly, the cost for entering the market is so high because of the supply management system that it'll basically be practically impossible. But did you know, if you want to raise chickens in Ontario, for example, and you want more than 100 chickens, you need to apply for 10,000 chickens. So in fact, rather than this wonderful family farm, salt of the earth, environmentally, humanly scalable type of agricultural practice that we think we're supporting through supply management, we're actually supporting, as you said, savvy, upper middle class businessmen who are basically engaged in factory farming. But, you know, I think the Canadian ideal of the farm and what that means is very, very different from the reality in 2015.
Yeah, and I mean, I wouldn't just say that's just a Canadian ideal. I think that ideal exists, as you say, across the industrialized world. There is this sort of longing, in some sense, to, you know, go back to the land, all that kind of thing. But you raise a very interesting point about, this idea, and it actually contradicts the outcome it claims to support, right? If you want to raise chickens in an organically friendly, environmentally friendly manner, you can't really do it within the supply management system. So I think you're right that, you know, the real kind of foodie movement, as you put it, for those sorts of things is actually harmed by this. And I think another thing to consider is, you know, when you look at certain moves within the U.S., what kind of happened was a lot of family farms either got crunched into these larger agricultural conglomerates, Or what they were able to do successfully is transition into making, you know, more, I guess you would say, boutique products that were, you know, organic, or they were very particular kinds of cheese, or things like this. So, I mean, I think that's part of it, is just the business model would need to really change if you want to get off that. But just to get off the supply management point for a minute, I guess another point I would raise in regards to is this actually a trade agreement is two things. The first is, you know, this again includes one of these investor state dispute settlement mechanisms. I think this is hugely harmful to sovereignty. This is hugely harmful to creating beneficial public policy. For those who don't know, basically allows corporations to sue governments if they employ public policies that have an effect on their profits. Infamously, recently, this was used to try to get mandatory cigarette labeling struck down in various countries. And the second, so that's the first thing. And, you know, the people keep saying, oh, well, we need those clauses in order to have investor confidence to move things in. But, you know, the Australian government previous to the current one, so the previous Abbott, Rudd Gillard Labor government, had its policy regarding trade agreements is that they would negotiate trade agreements, but they would not include investor state dispute mechanism. And they were still able to sign trade agreements. They were able to sign good trade agreements. So I don't think it's necessary to have that. And I would actually say that, you know, I guess I don't know how to term this, but, you know, that would be a policy that I think moderate social democratic parties should probably adopt across the board, saying, yes, we will negotiate trade, but we will not include investor state dispute mechanism. I believe that's currently NDP policy, but, you know, regardless. The second thing I would raise is, if you look at the way that the U.S. has been portraying this agreement in its press releases, it's very interesting because the first thing they said was, you know, we want to set the rules before China gets to set the rules. That was what their whole idea was, is that, I mean, peripherally, these rules would be to a higher standard. That's what they keep saying. Oh, well, this is at the highest labor and environment standards of any trade agreement, et cetera, et cetera. But they were also saying we need to set the rules before China sets them. So I would raise this point. Are these sorts of trade blocks becoming a new form of geopolitical organization? It's you know, ostensibly about trade, but really it's about aligning a group of countries together with each other in a sort of geopolitical economic sort of configuration where they can counter another country's rising power. Because you've seen the TPP as part of the Obama administration's broader pivot to Asia, quote unquote, that they want to do to sort of checkmate China there. I'm wondering if you have any particular interpretation of that.
Oh, it's almost certainly an extension of the pivot to Asia policy, which the United States implemented in 2009. It's pretty clear when you look at the partners to the TPP, countries like Vietnam, which actually fought a very bloody and destructive war that is, I think, forgotten in the West. Most people haven't even heard of it. Countries like Japan, which obviously has longstanding historical, shall we call them, disagreements with China. So it certainly is. And I want to touch on what you said. There is that quote by the Americans that we cannot allow the Chinese to set the rules. I think that really speaks to some discomfort and alarm on the part of the Americans as they realize that their historic role as indispensable, both militarily and economically, in Asia is being challenged by a rising China. And I think, speaking personally, it also speaks to the arrogance amongst the, for lack of a better term, ruling class or establishment in American intellectual circles, that there is a sort of indispensable quality to American leadership, and that the region without America would simply fall apart. And that's not true. You see China leading the way on creating an investment bank, which basically every country in the region, including American allies like Korea, have joined. And increasingly close relationships between traditional U.S. allies like Korea, South Korea, that is, and China. So I think there certainly is concern that the influence that the United States has traditionally enjoyed in the region is being challenged, and there's a need to buttress that economically with the TPP, and also from a defense standpoint with more military arrangements and security arrangements with Korea as well as Japan, through, for example, the deployment of these missile systems, which actually the Korean public and Japanese public seem to be pretty strongly against, whereas the government seemed to be more receptive to. So we'll see where that goes.
Yeah. Well, I think you raised an interesting point there regarding the you mentioned the investment bank, which is, of course, the AIIB, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, which, you know, has some pretty modest funding, at least initially, but was viewed as this, like, the fact that American allies were signing on to this, and not just Asian American allies, also Germany, the UK infamously decided to sign on to this, was seen in American political circles. People had this hair on fire sort of reaction to it, even though I would argue that a lot of the reason that those allies were willing to sign on to that and the reason that China decided to push it so aggressively was basically because a bunch of proposed reforms to the IMF and the World Bank, which would have given China more power commensurate with its current position in the world economy, were not adopted, right? So, I mean, I think this is sort of a sort of broad sort of back and forth. Okay, well, you don't let us reform the IMF, so we're going to make the AIIB. Well, okay, you don't do that, so we're going to make the TPP, and et cetera, et cetera, and on it goes. And, I mean, I think that's really unfortunate for a couple of reasons. Now, I should note, just to be fair, that China in recent weeks has sort of indicated a willingness to maybe join the TPP in the future. And actually, there is some evidence, again, we haven't seen the full text, that the language regarding currency manipulation within the agreement was sort of watered down in an attempt to kind of let China have some wiggle room in there. So that's just something to point out. But I think it's really unfortunate because there are, you know, concrete benefits to freer trade. There are concrete benefits to people's livelihoods. And the fact that it's becoming these blocks which aren't really interested in trade, they're more interested in geopolitics and security and sharing information between countries, I think that's really unfortunate. And I think, you know, the more and more we have these sort of regionalized trade blocks, whether it's Mercosur, Mercosur. I'm saying Mercosur, yeah. Whether it's Mercosur in South America, or whether it's the TPP, or whether it's the China-ASEAN Free Trade Agreement, etc., 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 all of this really distracts from the big game here, which is the WTO, which is where these disputes are supposed to be recognized and supposed to be dealt with, is in that forum. And the Doha round has just completely stalled. And it's completely stalled over basically vested interests digging their heels in industrialized countries to prevent agricultural products from the third world from getting into those countries and, you know, lowering consumer prices, providing more goods to people in first world countries, but then also helping, you know, farmers in third world countries where a lot of people are dependent on agriculture for their livelihoods. And I think that's really unfortunate. I think any government that was seriously devoted to free trade as an intellectual prospect would be aggressively trying to get the Doha round renegotiations going. But the reason I would argue that they aren't going forward is because first world countries have actually seen now that there's reached a tipping point where they can't just push free trade onto developing countries as a way to get them to open their markets. There needs to be a quid pro quo. You see that with the resolution of the U.S.-Brazil cotton dispute at the WTO, where Brazil won that case. Now, the U.S. was able to pay them off, but, you know, that's a real indication where this is going. And finally, the harms, you know, quote-unquote, of free trade are going to flow to the first world, and now the first world, being the hypocrites that we are deciding to bolt for the exits. And I think that's the real problem here of what this really speaks to. I don't know if you have any particular thoughts on that.
Well, when we speak about globalization, since the 90s, that term has been bandied around, sometimes with a lot of fanfare. What we're really talking about, especially in the past few years, is regional trade liberalization. But actually, globally, if you see the trade patterns, there aren't lots of strong links being formed between industrialized and developing nations. It's more about liberalizing trade between already industrialized nations. Of course, China's rise and their entry into traditionally impoverished regions like sub-Saharan Africa is actually the exception. And I think in this day and age, in spite of many valid concerns, China is really serving as a growth engine in much of Africa, as well as Latin America. So there's something to be said for that as well. There is this insularity, and it is driven in large part, as you say, by the unwillingness, because of the power of certain vested interests and lobby groups, for the industrialized global north to open up some of the sectors of the economy which heretofore have been dominated by cartels, like the supply management lobby.
Well, yeah. Well, I think it goes beyond that. I think it's more just, you know, we don't want to practice what we preach. It was called the Washington Consensus for a reason. This idea of, oh, you have to open up your markets. It came from the global north, and it was pushed on to these developing countries. And, you know, again, as I pointed out at the beginning, you know, people like Ha-Jun Chang or Eric Reinhardt would argue that this was a bad decision for them because it dismantled their ability to industrialize themselves. Now, there's debate around that. But nevertheless, you know, if you're going to preach free trade to other people, at least, for God's sake, practice it yourself. And I think the next thing to kind of point out there would just be to say, you know, I think there's a much broader kind of argument or discussion about the limits and benefits of globalization, which I think is a topic that, you know, we can maybe explore further in a subsequent episode. But I think we're running a bit long on this one segment. So I think if we want to kind of close up here, I just want to point out something that I found rather funny, putting back to this point about the U.S.'s position within this. In one of their press releases, they actually basically say, and I will put this on the show notes so you can read it yourselves, but they actually basically make a direct comparison between the TPP and gunboat diplomacy, which, of course, you know, for those who don't know, is basically a policy that the U.S. pursued relevant to Japan, forcing them to open up their markets. And it was literal using a gunboat to get that done, parking it in a harbor. So I guess, you know, the fact that they would make that sort of comparison, and it's kind of, you know, the way it's phrased is this sort of benign bureaucratic language where it's like, you know, in previous epochs, the U.S. had to use gunboats to do this, but now we have the TPP kind of thing. So, I mean, I think that I don't know if what your thoughts on that are, Alex, but I think that speaks to about the level of thinking we're expecting here.
Well, it sort of connects nicely with something that I had been planning on pointing out with regards to South Korea, in terms of what does, as you mentioned before, a small country like Canada or Korea do in the midst of these global forces and surrounded by much larger powers. And take the example of Korea. They did not, for a variety of reasons, join the negotiations that established the TPP. The reason being, at least partly, because they already have free trade agreements with the majority of the parties to the TPP. There's also considerations with regards to China, who South Korea is sort of having a rapprochement with and doesn't want to alienate, and is also more immediately, much bigger concerns, since about 25% of Korean exports go towards China. So they made the decision not to negotiate. Now that they've seen who's on board and what the potential benefits could be, they're reconsidering. But now they're being told that it's too late to enter into the agreements. They need to wait for the next round of negotiations, and they will probably have to make some concessions that are not very favorable to them. And for example, now that free trade agreement that they negotiated with the United States is basically useless, since Japan and the Japanese auto sector in particular has secured advantages that previously Korean companies had been assured of. So that agreement that they had is basically not worthless, but not worth nearly as much as the Koreans originally thought it was. So in spite of all of the worrying impacts of the TPP in terms of pharmaceuticals, internet freedom, intellectual property, from an economic standpoint, even though joining the TPP might damage Korea's competitiveness when it comes to chemicals, auto parts manufacturing, and the auto sector itself, it seems almost like unless they decide to abandon all of those powers and just put all of their money on China, they basically have a gun to their head and they need to join the TPP. And it's those sort of global forces that I think shape countries' decisions to take part in this agreement. It's not this wonderful, multilateral, cosmopolitan project that the proponents of these trade agreements make them out to be.
Yeah, well, I think that kind of comes back to this whole thing about, as you were pointing out, the regionalization of trade, and what that really has meant generally is that there's one country within that region that's setting up that trade bloc that's really big and really powerful and can use the power of other countries being included in that trade agreement and having market access as kind of a stick to beat them with. And in the case of this is, you know, the U.S. Now, that's not just the U.S. You know, you could make a similar argument regarding the Eurozone and Germany. You could make a similar argument regarding the ASEAN China free trade area and China. So it's not just necessarily American, but I think it speaks to this idea that now these trade agreements are now one big kind of pole country. Everything is going to be based around what their interests are and shaping that. Now, I should point out, you know, the U.S. made some token concessions in the, you know, negotiation of this agreement. So it never goes entirely one way. But, you know, broadly speaking, it aligns with that. And the fact of the matter is that, yeah, you know, you can say we're a much bigger market. We have much more customers who you sell things to with, in the case of the U.S., much higher disposable incomes. Are you going to sign this or not? If you don't sign it, you know, there's going to be all these consequences. And the problem is, you know, that causes countries to ignore the potentially harmful impacts of these things as on these other areas like pharmaceuticals, like internet freedom. And I think that's, you know, what it comes down to. And I think that's really shows the need for, if we want to have good trade negotiations, it needs to be, as you're saying, multilateral, which is to say it needs to be done at the WTO where it's supposed to be done. Okay, well, I think that's good for this topic. We'll come back to you with a discussion on China-Korea relations specifically after a short break. Okay, and welcome back to The Affairs Current. Our second topic tonight is broadly going to be a discussion about China's role in the world, although it is going to at least start off around the China-Korea relationship in specific. And I guess I'll throw to Alex to start this off, see as he has a bit more of an insider perspective, or a lot more of an insider perspective on this. I guess from the way, from your perspective anyway, what's the general feeling in the, let's say, South Korean body politic about the increasing influence of China in the world?
Oh, I think we should start off just for the benefit of listeners who don't necessarily have a lot of knowledge about the history of East Asia. Korea has been living with China at its border for around 5,000 years. That's the number that's often thrown around. I was once at a dinner with basically economic attaché to the Korean embassy in Ottawa, and we were talking about China's rise, and he said, let me tell you something about China. We know a lot about the Chinese. We've had to deal with them for 5,000 years. And I thought that, you know, it's really funny because the Chinese will also say, as a common refrain, we have 5,000 years of history. So that's just to say that the history history and ties between the two countries are really deep and complicated. Today, as I mentioned before, about a quarter of Korean exports are going to China. So obviously, China plays a really important role in Korea's economic well-being. At the same time, many people are uncomfortable with the increasing dependence of the Koreans on the Chinese, economically speaking. And Korea is also sort of awkwardly positioned between the Chinese on the one hand, with whom they sort of had a formalized relationship. Korea was part of essentially the Chinese Empire. They had to pledge loyalty to the emperor, but they were basically allowed to handle their own internal affairs as they saw fit. So there's that relationship and China's modern importance in the global and Asian economy on the one hand, and on the other, their formal economic and military and security ties, importantly, with the United States and that regional bloc. So I think it's a bit of an awkward relationship. Recently, Korea has been moving closer towards China. There have been a variety of bilateral meetings. There was one last month in which Koreans got the Chinese to support peaceful Korean unification for the first time. So that was a pretty landmark meeting, depending on how much you want to read into those statements. At the same time, people have been saying that China's relationships with the North are actually warming, and there was a senior figure from the Chinese Communist Party, a member of the Standing Committee of the Politburo, in attendance at the 70th anniversary celebration of the Korean Workers' Party in Pyongyang last week. So I think what you're seeing from both China and South Korea is sort of reluctance to put all of their eggs in one basket, as it were. I think that, you know, the United States is aware of China's increasing role in the region. China is also aware that they have not yet eclipsed America in terms of economic and military power, and Korea is certainly aware of that. And historically, I think Korea has done best when it's been able to pit powers who want a say in Korean affairs against each other. And I think that's a smart thing to do, rather than choosing to stick solely with the American, Japanese camp or the Chinese camp. They're trying to maintain peaceful and productive relationships with both sides. And we'll see in the next few years how that strategy pays off.
Well, that's sort of the classic move of small countries in a world of great powers, isn't it? You know, the whole idea of you play them off of each other, you get what you can out of one side, whether that's an export market, whether that's some kind of military support, because we should note, obviously, that you know, the South Korean military receives a lot of support from the United States, and now, as part of a sort of quid pro quo there, the United States is allowed to station troops in South Korea, allowed to, as you alluded to in the previous segment, regarding the deployment of these new missile systems that they've attempted to put in. And I guess the question there, you know, of course, is that's always framed around the idea of, well, we need protection from the North, or we need to restrain North Korea, that kind of thing. So that would be the first point there. But I found it interesting that when you were talking about South Korea being sort of positioned between two poles, you didn't, until the very end there, mention Japan very much. And that's kind of interesting, given the, I guess, historical relationship between the two countries. Obviously, a very fraught one, to say the least, a very wrought with a lot of military occupation, conquest, enslavement of Koreans by the Japanese, basically, and a legacy for which the Japanese are very reluctant to this day to own up to and to make amends for. So I guess the question that kind of falls out of that is, you know, within this sort of thinking in the Korean body politic, where does Japan have a role there? What's Japan's role in that sphere, shall we say?
Well, I think geopolitically, it's pretty clear that Korea, the United States, and Japan form something of a bloc and buffer to Chinese power. And certainly, the United States has an interest in keeping South Korea as a buffer against northern influence or northern aggression, which is a proxy for Chinese influence and aggression. But in terms of Japan, obviously, you've done a good job of pointing out sort of the sore spot in Japanese-Korean relations, which is basically history. They've actually invaded Korea a couple of times, not just in the 20th century, also in the 19th century and the 16th century, and there have been many other attempts. But you are seeing, at least on the part of the Korean establishment and the government, an attempt to reconcile with the Japanese. In Korean politics, usually it's sort of the opposite of what you expect in the West. The conservatives are the ones who are more willing to reconcile with the Japanese and foreign aggressors, and it's the left in Korea that is actually quite hostile towards the Japanese and nationalistic in some ways. Not to say that the right in Korea is not nationalistic, but so, for example, several months ago, Korea and Japan were negotiating an agreement that would allow them to forge closer security ties and share intelligence. And the excuse or the justification for this agreement, which many ordinary Korean people felt uncomfortable with, was that both countries have a mutual interest in staving off any threat from the North. So there is maybe a way in which the two countries are coming closer together as they perceive the common threat, which is North Korea. Although it is worth pointing out that there are not just historical but longstanding territorial disputes between the Japanese and the Koreans, in addition to the history, that make it difficult for the two to become at least, if not closer, warm. I think that's a long way off. So I'm talking about Longdo and also Dokdo, and also other disputes in the East Sea, which Japan was able to rename during its imperial period as the Sea of Japan. So there are lots of issues there.
Well, I think one of the concerns that I would, think would be really on the mind of Koreans in regards to this is the fact that there's an increasing mood of, I don't know what you would call it, but nationalist militarism in Japan, given that the relatively new prime minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, is a member of a group. I'm trying to remember the exact name of it, but it's escaping me at the moment. Nippon Kyosai or something to this effect, which is a sort of it's aligned with the ruling party. It's not officially part of it, but it is a group that is a right-wing nationalistic group. It denies that the Japanese committed war crimes. It wants to reconstitute the Japanese self-defense force as a formal army. And, of course, this comes at a time, a very acrimonious debate in Japan itself breaking out surrounding Shinzo Abe wanting to change the regulations and rules surrounding when the Japanese military can be deployed, because, of course, for those who don't know, as part of its wartime constitution, post-war constitution, the Japanese are not allowed to have a formal military. Their defense forces can only be used for defense purposes. But the current government wants to change that to be so it can engage in, quote, mutual self-defense, which most commentators sort of see as a point to kind of push the realm of operations that the JSDF is allowed to engage in into these alliances with other militaries where it could go out and engage in hostile acts beyond Japanese borders for the first time since the Second World War. So, I mean, if I was a neighbor of Japan, particularly given the historic and ongoing, as you pointed out, border disputes, not to mention the other history, I would be very concerned about this, not just from a left-wing perspective, but just in general. But I do think it's very interesting that you point out the whole thing about the left in Korea being more hostile towards the Japanese. And I think part of that stems from the fact that it was the left which was more engaged in the resistance to the Japanese during the war. There's a historical legacy there, obviously. And also, I mean, you point out that the reasoning behind these greater ties with Japan is, of course, the importance of checking the North and its aggressive acts. But, of course, the left in Korea has traditionally been identified, although you can speak to this more than I could, obviously, if this is still the case, but the left in Korea has traditionally been allied with pursuing some sort of detente with the North. This particular, you know, known as the Sunshine Policy. Now that's kind of widely seen as being a failure, but you know that there's that aspect to it as well. So I guess just to kind of bring those two together, do you see the increasing kind of, I mean, first of all, what's the Korean perspective on, you know, these debates within Japan about the use of the military there? But then the second question I would say is, do you think that the wanting to pursue greater closeness with Japan is more of a legacy of the perceived or actual failure of the Sunshine Policy?
So just to quickly address the first issue, regardless of attempts by the Korean government to grow closer with the Japanese, I think many Koreans are understandably concerned about expanding Japanese nationalist sentiment and militarism. But it's also worth pointing out that a majority of Japanese were very proud of the pacifist nature of their constitution, are opposed to Abe's intentions. And in fact, the opposition parties in Japan have made the pretty reasonable case that what is being rammed through the Diet at the moment is unconstitutional, that his excuses about this being purely for coming to the aid of an ally in another country under attack or anything like that is basically rubbish. And I think that's a pretty reasonable argument. In terms of I just want to address before answering your other question about the relationship between the left and the Japanese. I think many individuals within Korea were opposed to the Japanese during the colonial period. A lot of collaboration between certain members of Korean society and the Japanese colonial authorities, including Park Chung-hee, who is Park Geun-hye, the current Korean president's father, and many senior members of the civil service are descended from families that collaborated with the Japanese. Many people in Korea with wealth had ties with the Japanese during the imperial period. However, individuals like Syngman Rhee, who was certainly not a leftist, he was a fierce anti-communist, was in part able to hold on to power for so long after the Second World War because of his impeccable anti-Japanese credentials. So, yes, there to this day is a strong anti-Japanese sentiment from the left, but at the time, I think there was pretty broad-based support in Korean society for overthrowing the yoke of Japanese imperialism. I'm not sure if I completely understood your second question, so could you?
I guess what I was trying to get at was, is the move towards greater closeness with Japan, which you perceive and which is coming through all these sorts of dialogues between South Korea and Japan, do you see that as an after effect of the fact that the Sunshine Policy of pursuing detente with the North is perceived or actually has failed? So because of that, we can't address the aggressiveness of the North through negotiations with the North. Therefore, we need to ally with Japan in order to check their power. So I guess what I'm saying is, do you see a kind of cause-effect relationship between the abandonment of the Sunshine Policy and then moving towards greater closeness with Japan?
Well, certainly, as has been discussed, the right, so currently the Saenuri is sort of the conservative party in Korea, and they have historically allied themselves with the United States, and they have been more in favor of forging closer ties with Japan. The issue of Korean unification in this day and age is a generational one and also a political one. So while most Koreans will say they support unification, the conditions under which unification takes place and the terms on which unification takes place differ. So I think that the end of Sunshine Policy, yes, there were problems with the Sunshine Policy, and there were also accusations against Nomihyeong's administration, who was a considerably left-leaning president. That undermined the credibility of those negotiations, and they may be seen in retrospect as a failure, but I think the most important reason why unification talks collapsed is simply because of the results of the election following Nomihyeong's presidency, when Lee Myung-bak, who is a member of very right-wing church and certainly a dyed-in-the-wool conservative, he won and came to power. And that in and of itself was basically the death knell of any sort of rapprochement with the North.
Well, I guess the sort of follow-up question to that, and I mean, I don't know how well you could speak to this, but it's sort of my understanding that the reason Lee Myung-bak was able to win was because he basically was able to capitalize on the fact that a lot of Koreans saw the Sunshine Policy as being a failure, that it gave the North all this money, and the North wasn't being reciprocal in terms of what it was giving the South. So that would be kind of the point I would make just to that. I don't know if that rings true to you or not.
I mean, there were, Lee Myung-bak was, I'm not an expert on South Korean politics, certainly. My understanding is that the conservatives won that election in large part because of problems with the Korean economy since the 90s. And yes, perhaps the argument being made that we are giving all of this money to the North, it was basically seen as a form of welfare. I guess that would be the North American equivalent. That wasn't really reaping any dividends for the South. In the context of a troubled economy, combined with the fact that the candidate was a former conglomerate CEO and successful businessman, that sort of made the case for Lee Myung-bak becoming president. But I don't think that was an election fought solely on the issue of North-South reconciliation. I think there were other considerable factors, like certainly the aftermath of the Asian financial crisis in 97 caused exposed lots of problems with the Korean economy that exist to this day. And in fact, after Lee Myung-bak's term was up, in Korea, presidents can only run for one term, Park Geun-hye was elected pretty explicitly with the understanding that she would bring back the heyday of the Korean boom under her father, Park Chung-hee. It was basically her name that secured her position. Now, has the...
She's the Justin Trudeau of Korea.
That is certainly...
That's a facetious statement.
But certainly that...
Pierre Trudeau was many things, not a military dictator. Although... Anyway.
The whole War Measures Act thing. I know it's not completely related to the conversation, but I just want to note, at least from my perspective, those administrations have not delivered on the promised economic growth, nor have they tackled the fundamental structural problems with the Korean economy that have contributed to high youth unemployment, rigidity in the labor market, and so on. So actually, as is the case with conservative governments in the United States and Canada, there is this reputation that the conservatives have for handling the economy that actually doesn't bear fruit.
Well, the more things change, the more they stay the same, no matter where in the world you go, I guess. But I think when you reference the structural problems with the Korean economy, are you sort of talking about, of course, there's the very famous notion that the Korean economy is largely dependent on these, as you alluded to, conglomerate groups called chaebols. Chaebols, am I saying that? Chaebol, thank you. Are you referencing that, the fact that those are kind of still overpowerful within the Korean economy and are kind of, taking down state subsidies, as we alluded to in the previous segment, a very favored section of the economy, very well connected, the people in it have a lot of political power. Is that sort of what you're referencing, or is it more other things that you perceive?
Well, it's the rigidity of the Korean economy, which is a direct result of the undue influence that a handful of companies have in basically determining the political economic future of the nation, combined with the fact that not only the conservatives, but both main parties are riddled with corruption. Many people forget that Korea was not on the way to democracy before the late 1980s, and really they've only had civilian rulers since the mid-90s. So as a democratic project or an exercise in building robust institutions, that's ongoing. And because of that, I think there's lots of room for corruption and collusion between members of the ruling elite in government and the corporate makeup of the economy. So those two things sort of feed off of each other. There won't be reform until you can separate the vested interests in the Korean political establishment from power. But of course, because of the connection between the two, it's sort of mutually
self-reinforcing cycle. Yeah. Well, I think, I think often we're too quick to kind of say, these other countries are corrupt. Of course, as we said, a similar sort of process, I think, exists in all countries, but you're definitely right that, particularly, and it is often forgotten that South Korea is a relatively new democracy. So therefore you're kind of seeing this sort of unwinding of these old ties that, tend to proliferate amongst in authoritarian regimes.
Now, there is, though, I would add, a problem. So in terms of one big issue that Koreans, especially Korean youth, are dealing with nowadays, that because the chaebol still control such a sizable portion of the Korean economy, there are only a certain number of decent-paying, respectable jobs that can be created every year. Because of that fact, and the fact that the labor force is becoming increasingly educated and increasingly skilled, you have a huge problem, because not only do you have a large group of unemployed people, but you have a large group of highly educated, highly qualified young people. And since the number of jobs each year isn't really growing all that much, the impetus is for Korean youth to become even more educated. And so you have this very perverse relationship where the economy really isn't meeting the needs of the people. And because there's such a limited number of jobs, the race to become more qualified, more educated is growing. So you have a population that's becoming, potentially more able to contribute productively to the Korean economy, but an economy that isn't really responding to that. And that sort of lack of, I guess the problems with the labor market are reflective of the fact that the Korean economy is not, in spite of rhetoric from, let's say, the Americans or the free world, it's not a free market economy. It's very much a statist form of crony capitalism, I guess you could call it. And that's why you're seeing, for example, many Korean people going to work in Canada or work in the United States or even Japan, because they're simply not being guaranteed a job or quality of life that could have been expected before the financial crisis in 97. And that's the other big problem. Historically, the understanding was in Korea that these companies could hold a place of prominence within Korean society and within an economy, with the understanding that their employees would be treated like members of the family. But that sort of trust between Korean people and their companies has been eroded since job stability is no longer a guarantee and benefits are no longer a guarantee, and yet the companies still hold so much power. So that's what's going to have to change if there's going to be any fundamental changes in Korea's economic performance.
From what you're saying here, it actually strikes me that a lot of these issues are both well, similar to a lot of countries, I think there is a problem with people being, as you're alluding to, overeducated. They keep going back to school, getting more and more degrees, but there aren't really the jobs that take advantage of their skills. But then very specifically, I was thinking of, you know, if you look at Japan, under a very similar process, these highly conglomeratized companies that were allowed to exist within a huge portion of the Japanese economy with the understanding that, as you said, people would be treated like members of the family. People were very loyal to the companies. In Japan, these are termed zaibatsus. But then there was this crisis. They shed all these jobs, and they still occupy a huge portion of the economy, but they aren't really giving the kind of social benefit back to that to the country the way that they used to. And, you know, in Japan, this created what they called the lost decade, where, you know, growth was anemic. A lot of young people were not being employed, and it was a very bad time. And, I mean, do you think, I guess the question there becomes, you know, I don't think, at least from the outside, that South Korea is anywhere near that bad in terms of the situation. You know, in Japan, it was a really bad balance sheet problem. Banks had bought up all these assets that were now bust, and they couldn't deal with that. But, I mean, I guess the question then would become, you know, is South Korea looking at a situation where they're going to have anemic growth for a very, very long time, or do you think that there are changes that could be made that would get things moving again? And I'll add something to that, but I'll go ahead.
I mean, I don't think that I know we were discussing before the program the problem of currency in China and Japan, and how right now the renminbi is on the way up, and this was a problem in the 90s that contributed to the bubble in Japan, and when the bubble burst, lots of economic problems and stagnation ensued. Right now, the won in Korea is not facing the same problems, but I would say the conventional wisdom, basically, or the consensus is that after the 90s, very quickly, after some painful times as a result of an IMF bailout, Korean economy recovered very quickly. But, you know, the structural problems in the economy remain the same. And while the economy picked up pace again, the jobs that were created and the jobs that replaced the old good jobs were increasingly casualized, increasingly informal jobs, which, by the way, disproportionately impacted women. Single mothers, the division of labor is extremely gendered in Korea. So there are all sorts of problems. Certainly the power of the unions in Korea is not as strong as it was before the financial crisis. The position of women is certainly worsened. And the position of the average Korean worker is one of less security, less stability, more precarious working conditions. So, you know, what's the solution? I have no idea. I'm not an economist, nor am I a sociologist, but it seems clear to me that you have a handful of companies with good friends in government who have been able to hold on to their positions of power and influence within Korean society. The commensurate benefits that are supposed to flow from those companies controlling the commanding heights of the economy have not been flowing. And so, what I think needs to happen is both political reforms to address the issue of corruption and cronyism within the Korean government, and also structural reforms to take more power away from the Korean chaebol within the Korean economy. And although that might be a painful process, I think it's a necessary restructuring that needs to take place if the economy is going to be viable and deliver good jobs to the Korean people in the future.
Well, I think, you know, that perhaps there is sort of a move towards expanding into different export markets, as you said, with more trade coming with China. But of course, the problem there is, you know, for one thing, as you said, you know, China is kind of an unreliable trade partner. It does all sorts of nasty things with its currency. It subsidizes these state enterprises, which then compete. There's also a lot of questions about how they treat intellectual property, et cetera, et cetera. But then also just the fact that, you know, the Chinese economy itself recently has seemed pretty shaky. So, you know, putting your eggs in that basket even might not be the best strategy moving forward there. But I guess to kind of end it on a final note, you know, there is, you know, of course, we can get into the question of the DPRK as a kind of, let's get into that a little bit. So what the DPRK, of course, been the elephant in the room in the China-South Korea relationship. I mean, I guess, you know, if I was in that position, I probably wouldn't feel too great that, you know, a country that I'm trying to trade with, that I'm trying to develop a productive relationship with, is, of course, subsidizing a country which does all kinds of things to me. It, you know, launches missiles at me. It, you know, it acts in a very intimidating way. It stations troops on my border. It does all these things. I guess the question would be, is there a reluctance to develop a deeper relationship with China in Korea because of that issue, or is that kind of seen to one side?
Well, I think that there are some promising signs that China is changing its behavior in terms of both North Korea and South Korea. As I stated last month, they did commit to working towards peace on the peninsula and a unified Korea. Obviously, that's just rhetoric, and we need to wait for actions for them to follow through on their words. But I think that the Korean relationship with China's, the South Korean relationship with China is one premised on some realist assumptions about the way the world works and who holds power in the region. As time goes by, I think China is becoming more willing to resolve the issue on the peninsula. They can use North Korea as a proxy against the South and the United States, but really the ongoing caustic, really emotionally fraught and dangerous situation on the peninsula in the long term does not benefit China, Japan, or the United States. It is a security issue. It's not good for the Chinese economy. Recently, interestingly enough, the DPRK approved trading within a certain limit between border towns in China and North Korea. So there are signs, as well as increasing numbers of state-approved stores and stalls in Pyongyang, for example, and other cities. There are signs that the North Korean economy is opening up, and I think China is going to want to be helping that process move forward.
Well, but I guess the bit of a counter to that would be, of course, North Korea has shown signs that it was opening up before Kaesong Industrial Park, that kind of thing, and it kind of has vacillated between, you know, for reasons that appear very obscure to us, because North Korea is basically the definition of a black box in foreign policy terms. It's very hard to determine what is going on in that regime at any given time. And, of course, that's not helped by the fact that there are all these various sensationalistic stories that get passed around about North Korea, you know, Kim Jong-un feeding his uncle to dogs and such and such. But, you know, there is just that fact that it's very hard to figure out where their policy is going to go, and I guess that would be sort of concerning to me if I was trying to deal with that. But I do think you raise a very interesting point about, you know, the what China kind of desires out of that relationship, because, I mean, basically what they want is a buffer state between themselves and a major U.S. ally. And I think, you know, if the South Koreans were to pursue a kind of policy which was more independent, I guess, of the U.S., and they weren't seen as from at least from the Chinese perspective, as a proxy, if you will, of American power, you know, the Chinese might be more willing to acquiesce to a unified peninsula, or at the very least kind of tamp down their support for the North in financial terms. Because, I mean, if you look at it realistically, the North does not exist without China propping it up. It's an economic basket case. It can't feed its own population for the most part. It's highly reliant on these sorts of supports.
I would just also add, it's worth noting, it's not just purely security related in the conventional sense. It's not just a military concern about the presence of U.S. troops on the border. The collapse of the DPRK would result in a massive, unprecedented refugee crisis. And given the heavily fortified nature of the south-north border on the peninsula, most of those people would be heading to China. And that is a situation that the Chinese do not want under any circumstances. So I think...
I mean, do you think if let's, you know, I just want to kind of play with this idea a little bit. If the North Korean regime, for whatever reason, were to collapse, do you think that the situation would be akin to East and West Germany in the aftermath of that thing, where the South Koreans would be willing to welcome in their fellow countrymen back into the fold in some sort of arrangement? Or do you think it would be a lot more fraught and a lot more difficult?
Well, the North-South border, as you know, is the most heavily guarded and militarized border anywhere on the face of the planet. So just in a literal sense, that massive influx of people would be much more difficult. It's not as if they could tear down a wall and then millions of Northerners would flow into the South. So as I said, I think there's a real concern that many of those migrants and refugees would end up inside China, causing huge problems for the CCP. But the other problem with the German comparison is that, yes, there were problems in terms of how the West could take in a considerably poorer and in some ways less developed people and absorb them successfully. And even to this day, there are some problems in Germany that haven't been overcome. The East is still poorer than the West. Consider the fact that the difference in terms of economic performance and GDP and values between the North and the South is much, much bigger, and it dwarfs any difference between the East and West. So in terms of regime collapse in the North, what would happen? God knows. I don't think it would be a very pleasant situation for anybody. If there is reconciliation between the North and the South, I think it would have to be implemented in stages. That's just my instinct. Anything else I don't think would be workable at this point. Although I will say before, you mentioned Kaesong. That is a result of the Sunshine policies, and that factory is still in existence and still producing goods and jobs for the North. There were problems.
I mean, although to be fair, I mean, it exists because the South Korean companies can basically use the North Korean labor force there as I don't think it's too unfair to say basically slave labor. So, you know, I mean, I think there's a very concrete commercial interest that kind of would sustain that in the absence of the other portions of the Sunshine Policy.
Certainly.
That's just my cynical
Certainly, feeling. Although there was an ongoing labor dispute, actually, at the Kaesong Industrial Complex, which was resolved recently. The workers were demanding higher wages, and they secured those higher wages. But it's also worth noting, yes, there is a sort of cynical aspect to the relationship. The South can exploit the North for cheap labor, but actually the North is so much poorer than the South that those wages actually go a long way back home. It's the same reason that you have Korean laborers working in Russia. North Korean laborers working in Russia in all sorts of isolated camps. It's a way to generate currency and a way for people to either go to China or Russia and work under, yes, terrible conditions, but then bring back money that actually does the struggling Korean economy a lot of help. But in terms of economic reforms, the one final thing I would add is that by all, it's difficult to measure for all sorts of understandable reasons, but I think conservative estimates, the North Korean economy grew by about 1% last year. So it's not, you know, in the West, that would be anemic or stagnant growth. But, you know, for the North, I think that's...
Well, actually, that would be pretty good.
Yeah.
growth for certain Western countries.
Maybe post-recession, yeah. So I think you are right. Throughout the 90s and the early 2000s, there were lots of signs that Korea was going to reform. Kim Jong-il always sort of played up international audiences and said that he was liberal and opening, and people thought that he was very conciliatory and educated and funny man. And of course, there was a massive famine that resulted in the deaths of hundreds of thousands or millions of people. One final thing that we should touch on, of course, the Korean Workers' Party celebrated its 70th anniversary last week. And the only coverage it got in the Western news really was the display of Korean military hardware. And there was something made of the presence of the Chinese at that meeting. What wasn't really discussed was that Kim Jong-un actually made an address that lasted for about 20 or 30 minutes. And he didn't mention nuclear weapons a single time. There's actually a good piece in the Hangyoryo in Korea, which says he mentioned the people 90 times. And actually, he changed the phrasing of the policy of his administration from a nuclear weapons and economic development first to one of economic development and people first. There are signs of that. You know, he mentioned at one point that any war that America recklessly enters into, Korea will be prepared to respond to. And that was seen as sort of putting Korea on an aggressive war stance by certain members of the media in the West. But actually, if you look at the whole speech, the tone is quite conciliatory. So it encouraged people actually to look that up and see what he has to say, because it's not, I think what is coming out of the regime, at least judging from that speech now, is not very aggressive, and it shows signs that there is some willingness from the North to reconcile its relationship with the South and also with the United States. They actually, I think it was last month, put forward a formal request to the United States to sign a peace treaty, actually. So we'll see if that goes anywhere. Based on Republican behavior in Congress, I don't think it will, but who knows.
Well, you know, they just let that Iran deal slip through. We can't have another detente anytime soon, I think. I mean, I think you definitely raise an interesting point. I mean, I guess there would be two, perhaps, reasons why that sort of a speech would not be adequately covered in our media. The first being that, again, there is this problem of North Korea as a black box. It's very hard to determine, like, what actually they want to do. Like, yes, he can make this speech, but he might wake up tomorrow morning and decide, you know what, I'm going to go in this other direction, and it's very hard to determine. But the other thing is, of course, you know, there is an unwillingness to cover North Korea seriously in the Western media, and what I mean by that is to cover it anything other than, ha-ha, look over there, look at this crazy regime where they have, you know, these big portraits of Kim Jong-un, and they, you know, sing these songs, and they have all this crazy military hardware and all these things. So, I mean, I think there's a real failure to engage with it on a level beyond that kind of, you know, like that stupid Seth Rogen movie that got made, you know. That's the image of North Korea in the Western media is really that. And I'm not saying that doesn't have some degree of truth to it, but I am saying, you know, if you know, as Sun Tzu, you know, said, you know thine enemy, you know, and you have to take these things seriously when you're talking about geopolitics.
And finally, it's important, just we're talking about history, and history is always important, but especially in understanding contemporary East Asian politics, a basic grasp of the history is really vital. And the bunker mentality of the North Koreans stems from the fact that North Korea was literally a bunker between 1950 and 1953. The United States, if you want to inquire into the aggression that Korean people, also in the South, by the way, feel against the American and the American military, stems from the fact that the United States dropped more bombs on Korea than they did during the entire Pacific War, during the entire Second World War, in its fight against Japan. So that was, I think, 635,000 tons of bombs were dropped on Korea, 32,500 tons of napalm, and tens, hundreds of thousands of civilian casualties in total, not just because of the Americans. More than 1 million Korean civilians died in that war. So I think you really need to look at the history of Korea, the history of division, the history of the Korean War, and also America's presence on the peninsula. To this day, their armed presence on Korean soil to understand why North Korea has an issue with the United States. If the United States were far removed from the situation, then North Korea would not be rhetorically attacking the United States at every turn.
Yeah, I mean, I think that kind of speaks to, and again, I don't, you know, I want to phrase this very carefully, but just to say that, yeah, like as you're saying, the North Korean rhetoric towards America does not have, is not ahistorical. It has a historic basis. It has a, if you like, rational basis for being. Now, obviously, that doesn't excuse all kinds of the actions that they engage in, but it is to say that that doesn't happen for no reason. I think, you know, to go back to actually the previous episode where I was speaking with Miles about this, you know, again, I think it speaks to a blindness of this, you know, why do these people hate us? Like, why, what have we done to make them, and, you know, it's a real ignorance and complicity of the crimes of, in this case, America, or the West more broadly, to say, like, yeah, you know, these people might have a rational reason to hate us. Now, maybe they're not expressing it in the greatest way. They might also be run by totalitarian dictators, and that's also a problem. But yeah, you know, I think you're very right to draw us back to that history there. Okay, so I think we've run a bit long on this segment, but that's good. We had a really good discussion. Is there any final points you'd like to add, or would you like to draw it there?
Oh, no, I think that's good. Thank you.
Okay, so now we'll move on to recommended readings to finish up the podcast. Okay, we're now back on The Affairs Current with recommended readings. I will first throw to Alex to give you his.
So the piece that I chose today is very much in line with what we've been talking about. It's by Doug Bandow in The National Interest, and it sort of takes a realist perspective on the United States' role in the Korean Peninsula. It's titled Newsflash, the U.S.-South Korea Military Alliance Isn't Working, and the main argument of the article is basically contained in the title. Basically traces the history of the U.S.-South Korea relationship and says while it started out of necessity, there's no real reason why the United States should be shouldering the majority of South Korea's defense responsibilities today, that any mature nation should be able to provide for its own defense and defense of its sovereignty, and that South Korea certainly is beyond a position where it can afford to do that. It also makes the interesting point that part of South Korea's economic development and, for example, their success in educating its workforce flows from the fact that they haven't had to make the sort of difficult trade-offs other countries do, that they can spend more money on education or on developing industries for export because they don't have to worry about a big defense budget. So definitely check that out.
Yeah, it's a very interesting article, and I've heard sort of similar criticisms to the one that you just said about the sort of the fact that the U.S. provides all the support for them kind of doesn't make them have that guns or butter sort of dilemma that other countries are faced with. And, you know, a similar sort of objection is often raised by people like John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt regarding the NATO relationship between U.S. and European countries, saying, yeah, the Europeans are able to fund all this great infrastructure and education and all this because the U.S. is providing them the security umbrella, and meanwhile, the U.S.'s internal infrastructure is just crumbling to bits and all this. So I thought it was a very interesting article from that realist perspective. Okay, so my recommended reading is not extremely topical, what we've been talking about so far, but it is a very interesting article nevertheless. It's by Tom Engelhardt. It's at the American Conservative. It's called The Fog of Intelligence, and I'm not going to go too deeply into it, but it's basically, he's basically making an argument from a military perspective about why this sort of flood of intelligence that comes through agencies like the NSA, like CENTCOM, like the CIA, is really harmful and quite counterproductive for running a military in an efficient way. And the basic argument he's making is, like, despite the fact that the U.S. has all these sprawling intelligence agencies that employ, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, it still keeps getting caught, you know, off guard or flat-footed, whatever term you want to use, when things like Russia's entry into Syria or anything else like this, you know, continually being caught off guard. And he's basically making the argument that one of the reasons for this is just this flood of intelligence makes it impossible to effectively sort and effectively analyze all the signals they're receiving. So he's basically kind of making an argument that, you know, even despite, you know, aside from all the security and privacy concerns that come with these sorts of agencies' activities, if they were pared back and scaled back to their original intent, they would actually be a lot more effective at doing what they're supposed to do and provide the military with effective intelligence. You may agree or disagree with the thesis of the article, but he definitely argues it extremely well, and it's a perspective on these issues that I haven't heard before, and I'm really grateful to have analyzed in that way. Okay, so I think that's about it for this episode. A bit more of a theme topic than usual this week, but that's good. Once again, our email is theaffairscurrent@gmail.com. Our blog, well, the show notes will be posted, theaffairscurrent.blogspot.com. We welcome all feedback. Do you have anything final to add, Alex, before we sign off?
Only that I'm sorry that we didn't have even more time. It's obviously a region of growing importance, and I hope we can be back in the future to talk more about it.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I said off air to Alex, you know, there were some interesting discussions within that TPP discussion about that could have gone further about the nature of globalization in general and all these kinds of things, what states should be doing to support their population in a world of increasing trade. But we'll hopefully get to those in a subsequent episode. So for everyone here at The Affairs Current, signing off and wishing you a great week.